Good evening, everyone. And when I was about 14, I went to a boarding school for a few months in Switzerland, high up in the Alps. And I was very careful in choosing the boarding school that I went to because I chose one that was co-ed. That was very important. There were a lot of unisex choices. And I also chose one that was in a beautiful location, high up in the mountains and side of the Alps, and right next to a ski resort. And when I got there, I found out that I'd chosen the boarding school in Switzerland that took in all the delinquents from the other boarding schools. So much of a careful choice, looking at pictures. And it was a beautiful location, and I was there for about 3 months in springtime. And I was walking on the roads one day near the school with a friend, an older friend, 17. And I was kind of in awe of this amazing alpine sky and the snow-covered mountains and the beautiful kind of green meadows or pastures that kind of roll down the hill. And it was kind of, just being this little person walking on this little road in this great, big, majestic landscape. And in awe of all this, I kind of said to my friend, something like, why are we here? What's the meaning of life? Why are we alive? And my friend said to me, "Don't be silly." And since he was older and knew better, of course, I thought that I was being stupid in asking those kinds of questions. So I just kind of closed up that part of me. Forget that. I'm not going to show that to anyone again. Until I'm in my late teens, I guess, for another 5 or 6 years. And I think back at that, there's some feeling or some idea that was kind of a real pity. It's the movement within us to ask deep questions or to be in this kind of awe at the mystery or the majesty of life or the uniqueness of what it means to be a human being. What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean that you have this life to live? Where does it all come from? My son now, who's 3, last night, putting him to bed, he wanted to know where did the world come from? So, now if you kind of have a theological background, you have easy answers, especially ones that a 3-year-old can understand, because he said, "Who made this world?" But Buddhists don't have the same kind of theological ideas that other religions have, so I couldn't give him the easy answer, so what do I say? So I made an answer for him, and then he wanted to know, what was before the world? And he wanted to know, who made the sky? Or how did the sky get made? And if there's no world, then there's no sky, right? And he was asking all these kinds of questions, and I was doing my best to try to answer. But, I remember, what it was like as a 14-year-old asking kind of similar questions, and then having that kind of curiosity or that sense of awe closed up because someone told me that was silly to have the kind of thoughts, those kind of ideas. And I think oftentimes our society, with its busyness or its concern for materialism or many things, is not very kind to the little flicker within us of questioning, of awe, of the kind of spiritual quest of wanting to look for, to find, or touch into some deeper sense of truth or understanding or some sense of our true self or some possibility of deep peace or... And sometimes there's a little kind of flame inside of us that you know, the kind of the winds of society would just blow out, you know, the first chance it gets. And off we are, kind of busy with work and homes and family and activities and bank accounts or whatever. And but to kind of let this kind of seed, this flame, to nourish it, to blow gently on it so it grows and grows and becomes kind of a shining light rather than something we have to be embarrassed about or hide or lock away. I was thinking of talking today about three different areas, three different aspects of that I think are quite important in a spiritual life. And it might at first seem a little bit odd that I would lump these three together. But what I'm thinking about today is solitude, listening, and speaking. That these three areas are very important areas for people engaged in the spiritual life, at least the Buddhist life. To cultivate our sense of solitude, to cultivate our capacity to listen well, and to cultivate our capacity to speak well, to speak with wisdom and kindness. And if you can do those three things, then you go really far in developing your inner self. Solitude maybe is for some people obvious that this belongs to spiritual cultivation, and some people it's far from obvious. One of the kind of formative experiences for me in my certainly my spiritual life was a story I've told often, but when I was living on a small farm that had five dairy cows and some calves, and the couple who ran the farm went on vacation for a week, and so they left me to take care of the farm. And I was about 20, and I had no idea. I'd never before in my life been alone for any length of time, more than a few hours probably. And here I was alone for 7 days, and I wasn't planning it. It wasn't like I was thinking, you know, how it would be nice to be on retreat and be alone. And those kinds of thoughts were inconceivable to me. I didn't have a place, had those kind of categories in my mind. I just knew my friends were leaving, and they asked me to take care of the farm, and there was no one else around. In the course of the 7 days, the only person I saw was I saw the mailman walking up the road to the mailbox, kind of at a distance. But I didn't talk to him, just the only person I saw. And I had these five girlfriends then that I had to milk every day. And I felt very close to them. And what happened to me during those 7 days of being alone was that many of the ways in which I think and many of the ways in which I'm kind of concerned about how other people see me and how I see others and the kind of complications of social life dropped away because I didn't have a social life at all. And it was just myself. And in the course of the days, I noticed that my sense of perception got sharper and stronger. I was much more aware, much more in the present moment, though I had no idea that that was a good idea, particularly. And I found myself kind of, that I was really amazed at how everything began seeming kind of very sharp and highlight. Everything I looked at seemed kind of like it shimmered with light almost. And that aware, sense of strong awareness that developed also was inward. I became much more sensitive to my thoughts and my feelings inside. And I'd never before been so acutely sensitive to the movements of my mind, what I was thinking and what I was feeling. It felt almost as if the inside and outside were equally kind of radiant and alive for me. And I felt very still. I felt inside, by the end of the 7 days, I felt very still inside, very complete, very expansive. Very peaceful. But the keen thing for me was that the sense of intimacy, the sense of real sharp seeing, the sense of perception, of really being present for things in a way that I hadn't before. And then my friends came back, and all that went away pretty quickly. And then, partly to my credit, the very important question then that I had for my spiritual life after that, from many years, kind of fueled my passion for practice for a number of years, was how could I have the sense of solitude together with other people? Or how can I have this intimacy or this peace together with other people? And I say it to my credit, because it would have been easy to have come to the conclusion, well, this was great, and I get it by being alone, so I'm going to go be a hermit. And so off I go. But rather, I had some, I don't know where it came from, I had this idea that I didn't want to reject my social world, but I wanted to learn how to enter the social world with that sense of solitude, that sense of freedom, the sense of intimacy, that sense of not being caught up by all kinds of things, so that shimmering and aliveness and presence could be there everywhere. So that was my goal, that was what I set myself out to do. And what I've learned over the years, over and over again, is the great value of solitude. That we have to, it really helps to really appreciate solitude and to take some refuge or some root ourselves in solitude. Whether it's real solitude that takes you away from people, or it's a kind of very healthy sense of solitude that can be in the midst of even, you know, many people, a cocktail party even. Some people cringe at the word solitude, because for many of us, solitude is, our inner kind of life is covered over, crusted over by senses of alienation, isolation, loneliness, aloneness, fear of others, fear of rejection, all kinds of issues. And so solitude seems to be kind of, I don't want solitude, because that's kind of is entangled with all those other feelings of loneliness and isolation and alienation. And so they maybe can't hear what a fantastic and necessary thing solitude might be. Solitude is not loneliness. Solitude is not alienation, or even, you know, aloneness particularly. Solitude is the capacity to be alone, or to be solitary, to be one, without being caught up or entangled or lost in our relationship to other people. And many of us get so entangled and lost in those relationships. We're worried what people are going to think about us if we open up to them. We're worried how people are going to see us. We're worried about how we present ourselves. We're worried about, you know, the conversation we had, about the past, what people did to us. And somehow our sense of who we are, our sense of what we need in our life, is very deeply entangled with our relationship to other people. And it makes some sense that's the case, because human beings are phenomenally social. And, you know, a very deep sense of who we are is our social connectedness to others, a relational sense of self. But it's possible to discover within us a depth of a sense of being at home in ourselves that doesn't require any kind of, doesn't require defining ourselves in relationship to anybody else. A sense of being at home in ourselves that doesn't require us to receive anything from anybody else, or even to give anything to anybody else. A sense of a homeness that can come just being here, maybe we'd say in a kind of solitary way, alone, just one. And the paradox, of course, is that, and of course, but the paradox is that the more solitary you can be in the way I'm talking about, the actually greater is your sense of connectedness to other people. And actually, what some people will say is you can only have a deep, loving relationship to other people if you've learned how to be solitary. If you've learned how to be at home in yourself with no needs from other people, then you can go into your relationships very lovingly, because then you go into your loving relationships without having confusion of fear and hope and expectation and neediness and all those things that might occur. There's a beautiful quote by Rilke. It says something like, he sees it as the fundamental task, or the sacred task of all couples, is that each person in the relationship needs to guard the solitude of the other. That was very nice. Need to guard the solitude of the other. Guard that sense of independence or aloneness or wholeness or completeness or being at homeness in the other person, And many times we don't do that. Sometimes we're kind of like leeches in other people. We want something from them, we demand something from them, and we don't really give them their independence. But one of the fantastic ways of meeting someone is as two solitary people. Two people who are at home in themselves. And being at home in themselves, the relationship then is qualitatively often much deeper than if we're not at home in ourselves and we're trying to fill all kinds of needs in the relationship we have. So solitude is, I think, a very helpful quality to cultivate and learn how to be comfortable with solitude. There was a famous thinker who said something like spirituality or religion, the essence of it has to do with what you do when you're alone, when no one's watching. What you believe or what you're not doing anything for anybody else. You know, what your deepest values are that you live by when no one's watching. So I find it very useful to go off sometimes and be alone. And go for a walk in the woods or up in the skyline or go to the beach or just go and close a door and be alone in a room. Or the physical solitude, to actually be separated from people, is very helpful. And it has a way of sometimes settling things away and clarifying and highlighting what's really going on in our life. We keep being busy and doing many things. Sometimes it's very hard to know oneself. The busier people are, the less they know themselves. I've been surprised how many times people have gone on retreat, for example, and come for an interview and said, I had no idea that was part of who I was. I didn't know that I had those kinds of concerns, those feelings, those values or whatever. They're too busy to notice. Part of the function of going on retreat is to let ourselves catch up to ourselves. And that's what happens when you stop. So to go off and spend some time in solitude and discover how comfortable you are with that, how uncomfortable you are with that, and work with it, it's possible to be, it's necessary to be, ultimately, deeply comfortable with solitude. But that's not all of a spiritual life. A big part of it is also how we are with others. It's part of the spiritual life. It's not separate from it. And for that, listening, the practice of listening is very important. How we listen. There's a great quote where someone said, God gave us two ears and one mouth so we can listen twice as much as we speak. And then there's this, I don't know if you probably don't know, there's the Order of St. Benedict, the Catholic monastic order, has the rules of St. Benedict. And the first rule, the opening word of the rules is in Latin, ascolta. And ascolta in Latin or Italian means listen. So the beginning of the monastic rule is just listen. And I've been told, I don't know if this is true, that the word obedience in the Latin etymology of the word means to listen. To be obedient means to listen. The disciples of the Buddha were called Sanskrit shravakas, savakas. And which means listeners, those who listen. To have the capacity to listen is very close to the practice of mindfulness. Some people will use listening, capacity to listen, as a doorway to becoming more mindful and more present. Listening, to listen or to hear, to listen kind of spacious, openly, to listen without interfering, to listen without needing to rush ahead and say what we believe is true or to interrupt someone, but to listen deeply to what's going on. I read a story or a joke, I guess one of these wise stories, of some man who goes to his rabbi and says, I'm having a really hard time with my wife. We're having a lot of conflict. What should we do? And the rabbi says, oh, go back and listen to your wife. So the man comes back to the rabbi some weeks later and says, well, I'm doing what you said. I'm listening to her. But we're still having a lot of trouble. And the rabbi said, oh, go back again. You're supposed to listen to what she's not saying. So there's many ways of listening, but to listen to really pay attention, to give someone attention. You probably know that one of the, maybe it's a cliche or one of the kind of theories of good psychotherapy is it really 99% of good psychotherapy occurs because the therapist is a good listener, or at least the client thinks he or she is. And the listening is very healing, to be heard, to really feel like someone's listening to you. To offer someone your ear, to listen to someone and connect to them in a deep way, to hear what they're not saying even. The feelings, the motivations that are behind what they say. A friend of mine who some years ago found himself at the beach parking, in a parking dispute. He pulled into a parking space that someone else thought should be theirs. I don't exactly know what the story was. But the other guy was furious at him and got out of the car and was yelling and screaming. And my friend listened for a while and didn't interfere or defend himself or do anything. And after a while, my friend said to him, "You're having a hard day, aren't you?" And probably the way he said it was just right. I mean, you have to be careful how you say these things. But he, you know, probably he just, you know, he was very attentive and listening, and he just somehow he said it, and the guy just relaxed his shoulders and took a deep breath and said, "Yeah, that's the truth." And then they had a whole different relationship, and you know, the whole thing changed. A lot of it had to do because my friend was listening to what's really going on for this person, rather than kind of butting heads around this conflict and the words and flinging back the insults. When we listen deeply, we're not just listening to, you know, words or ideas. And I think we're listening, we can listen, I think, to the depths of a person, to their soul, to their heart, to their deep motivation, their psyche, to the capacity of that person to be loving, the capacity of that person, the other person, to be at peace. Or to offer that from us, to listen as a way, our listening can be a sense, we offer them whatever depth of presence we have available within ourselves. We offer the person our peace, our loving kindness, our heartfelness. It's a kind of an offering to listen. And many of us don't listen very well. It's a whole art that can be learned, developed, how to be a good listener. And I think it belongs to a spiritual life, cultivating the capacity to listen. It's a great gift we give to others, and it's a maybe more important gift that we give to ourselves. I think that we are transformed by being good listeners to others, as opposed to rushing in with our thoughts and our ideas or getting lost in our fears and our concerns. To have the kind of stillness within us that can really listen and not get in the way of what's being said. It also ensures that our life is connected to other people in a deep way. For me, it's very important that a spiritual life feel like it's deeply connected to the world around you. To me, it's kind of inconceivable a spiritual life would not be. So, whereas I think solitude is centrally important, being in relationship to other people is also centrally important. And the beauty of it is the two of them work together. The capacity to be solitary really supports the capacity to be in relationship. The capacity to have this be at home in oneself that solitude represents supports the possibility of being this kind of listener I'm talking about, the really good listener. And the third aspect of practice I'm thinking about today is this thing about speaking, to be a good speaker, to speak consciously, carefully, mindfully. It's been said that some people choose their clothes more carefully than they choose their words. What does that say about us? Then I've heard also kind of a saying from Tibetan Buddhism that says, when meditating, watch your mind. When out in public, watch your mouth. Pay attention to what goes on when you speak. Our mouth is kind of like a doorway deep to ourselves. If you listen to your own voice, to what you're saying, the way you listen to someone else, you'll find that what you say, what you're about to say, what comes out of you, and what motivates it, why you're saying it, you'll find out all kinds of things about yourself. That will go, if you keep doing it, it'll go deeper and deeper, deeper into what really makes you run, what really motivates your life. To pay attention to your listening, to your speaking, is a very, very powerful mindfulness practice. I find in myself, sometimes it's a little bit embarrassing to admit it, but you know, that I listen to myself speak sometimes, and sometimes I notice that I just said something, not because that person needs to know that very important piece of information, because, you know, but rather I'm saying this thing because if I'm trying to influence them to think well about me. Because if I say that about what I've done, then they'll be more forgiving of me, or they'll think kindly of me, or they'll think I'm special or something. It's very embarrassing. You know, I notice, oh, why did I do that? And they don't need to know that for any other reason except that I'm trying to predispose them to like me by seeing me in a certain way. Is that the depth of motivation that I want my life to be coming from? So by paying attention to that and noticing that impulse, there's a chance maybe to think about that. Maybe let go of the first impulse to speak, first reason. And then maybe, is there some deeper reason to speak here? Maybe what I should be doing is just listening more carefully to this person rather than telling them, you know, something I think they need to know that they don't really need to know. Or maybe there's something I can say that is more useful for the situation, that doesn't involve trying to, you know, manipulate them to think kindly about me in some particular way. So a lot can be learned by just paying attention to our speech. But also, mindfulness of speaking is more than just being aware of speaking. In the Buddhist tradition, at least, it also means paying attention to what we speak about and choosing what we speak about in a mindful way. And so there's guidelines that at least the Buddhist tradition gives on when you could speak. The impression I had is sometimes when I was in Asia, some of the monastics that I spent time with, it was kind of like the impression I got was the default mode of being for them was not to speak. You know, if there was like a question, should you speak or not speak, they didn't speak. They, you know, they preferred to be quiet. That was kind of what they did, was they were quiet. But then sometimes you have to speak. And so what are the guidelines for when you speak? The guidelines that Buddhist tradition gives are four. And the first one probably is the most important, and that is only speak the truth. If you speak the truth, you have less to remember. Only speak the truth. And if you just did that, I think our life, our society would be transformed. But speaking the truth means, of course, not just simply obvious ways of lying and speaking the truth, but also means avoiding lies of omission, perhaps exaggerations. Is exaggeration a truthful way of speaking? So, speaking the truth. And I think it's pretty common in many spiritual traditions, the importance of speaking truth. The second is speak what is kind. Be kind in your speech. Is what I'm going to say a kind thing to say? It might be true to say, but is it kind? Actually, it's not kind at all. It's the truth, but you're using it as a weapon. Boy, I'm going to get that sucker. I'm going to tell him, you know, exactly, you know, the truth and just blast him out of the water with the truth, you know. The people use the truth as a weapon sometimes. Is it kind? Is what I'm about to say kind? And there's a whole issue. What does it mean to be kind when you have things like tough love, maybe? But is it kind? Is it loving, what I'm about to say? The third criteria is it useful to say this? It might be true, and it might be kind, but the person's not going to hear it that you're going to speak to. It's not going to have any impact. It's not useful. It has no purpose. There are some people who simply can't hear what you have to say. And why waste your energy if the person can't hear? Why bang against a, you know, locked door for too long? It's not going to open. So is it useful? And then the fourth one in the Buddhist tradition, so is it true? Is it kind? Is it useful? And the fourth one is it conducive to concord? Does it help create social harmony? Does it bring people together? This is very important in Asia, in India, China, and Japan, countries I know a little bit about, the idea of harmony. The idea of concord, of being kind of not being in conflict with the people around you. Does it create harmony? what I'm about to say. Does it bring people together, or does it separate and isolate people? Does it create separation, or does it create intimacy or a sense of knowing between people? If you're angry with someone, for example, the way you speak that anger or about that anger, is this going to create greater separation, or is it going to create greater possibility of reconciliation? When we're angry, sometimes last thing we care about is reconciliation. What we want to do is get back at that person. We want to strike at them. We want to make some, you know, we want to sometimes hurt them back or whatever. Is it conducive to social concord? Is it conducive to bring people together, reconciliation or harmony, what I'm going to say? So things like gossip, for example, is usually not conducive to social concord. Gossip, more often than not, tends to divide people and create, gossip causes tremendous harm in our society. Even when it's true, it can cause harm. I find myself increasingly uncomfortable talking about other people who are not present. I still do it. I know some people who don't do it, or at least say they don't do it. And I still do it. It happened today several times when I was talking about some other person who wasn't there. And I find myself increasingly uncomfortable about it. I think some of the discomfort is unwarranted. It's just that I've kind of entered this terror area and I'm unsure about it now. But often it's not very, often we start talking about other people and we would never say that thing when the other person was present. And that's one of my guidelines, is I try at least to say things that I would not feel embarrassed or reluctant to say if the person was actually present. And sometimes I do say something about someone that seems kind of strong and they're not present. And then I'll try to go find the person and say, you know, we had this meeting, I had this conversation with someone, and this is what I said about you. I want you to know what I've been saying about you, because it felt, you know, I don't want to be talking behind your back. I want you to know what I'm saying. So is it conducive to social concord, to harmony? To pay attention to these three areas, to solitude, to our capacity to listen, and to our speech, will clear the ground a lot, will clarify and give you food for practice, for reflection, for transformation that will probably serve you for the rest of your life. These three areas are very powerful and very useful areas for doing spiritual practice. And I really would encourage you to think about the last two, all three, but the last two, listening and speech, so that your whatever spiritual life you have, whatever practice of mindfulness you're trying to bring to the rest of your life, that you think about it being directly relevant and important to bring it into your social life also. So your social life is part and parcel of your spiritual, your meditative life. So, thank you for listening. I'll try to listen now. So you have anything you want to say, or comments, or questions? Yes?
What you said that, there's various ways to go about learning how to be a better listener. Can you talk a little bit about what those are?
Well, one of the ways is to start practicing, and to go and, to restrain the tendency to rush in speech. And maybe try to create a little bit more silence in speech when you speak, so that when you finish speaking, when someone's finished speaking, don't come right in the heels of what they say with your words, but rather have a pause. In different situations, different lengths of pause seem appropriate or comfortable, but let there be a pause and see. Sometimes I'm surprised. I'm ready to kind of give some person advice, right? Okay, I know what, I've heard them out for a while, okay. And then when I wait and don't give my advice and then give space for that person to talk more, and sometimes asking a very good question encourages further them to speak more. And being a good listener also entails being a good questioner, asking some really good, what's a good question? Someone said something, okay, let's see, is there a good question that I ask further to help go deeper with this topic? And then I'm surprised how often, you know, my great piece of advice that I had, you know, either was, you know, irrelevant because I didn't understand the situation, and or the person had great wisdom themselves, and the fact that I let that person speak further, maybe ask some questions, that came out on its own. I didn't have to say anything myself. Do you have anything in mind when you're asking the question?
No, dealing with my kids all
the time. Oh, kids. She's, oh.
You're older than
your kids. Oh, yeah, yeah. I should have, yeah, kids. I think that I have to just, you know, whenever someone asks about kids, I just shouldn't answer any questions. I'm not qualified. What? But, you know, with my son also, I mean, listening is very important to him because I find it very, very important to be trying to listen what he's not saying, because, you know, it's often something deeper is going on than meets the eye at first. So if he's acting out or being difficult, you know, maybe my first instinct is to say, you know, or... But what's really going on? And maybe he's lonely, or maybe he's afraid because something happened at school. So, you know, something happened to you at school today? You know, occasionally say, oh yeah, this other kid, he was, you know, he pushed me over. I didn't understand why, and then we can talk about it. So with kids, I think sometimes listening is the kind of operating principle I have with my son. Is that or the first operating principle, a theory or whatever, is that if I listen really well and can there's some way of speaking to him or responding to him that'll settle him. If I can just find out what it is, something's bothering him, and if I can just listen and find, I can say that thing which will be settling for him. Like one of the things we've learned, for example, is that our son, he likes to know what's going to happen. And so rather than just telling him when something's about to happen, what's going to happen, we tell him ahead of time, sometimes a day ahead. And that settles him, for example. And so that's my theory. You know, sometimes it's hopeless. Yeah?
What you said about solitude, I can imagine how it would be if a person was married and had children and was... had a very full, busy life, that, you know, it would be nice to go take a walk, but I'm single, I'm alone all the time, and I see the distinction between alone and solitude. I have so much solitude that I'm frankly kind of afraid to go on retreat. I mean, maybe for a lot of reasons, but maybe you could try to say something about the different quality that solitude might have for someone who has a lot of it, and maybe hasn't figured out how to work it into the spiritual practice or how it relates. Because of all those things that you said are often twinned in people's minds with solitude, rejection, alienation, isolation.
Yeah. Why do you spend so much time alone?
I enjoy it.
What's the downside of it?
Feeling disconnected from the rest of the world.
Uh-huh.
But the things I like to do are solitary types of things. I mean, I can call someone up, how would you like to come over and read a book with me?
Maybe you should read books in libraries.
I'd like to read a book in my special place.
And do you have any sense of what your time alone does for you? Why is it you enjoy it? What does it do for you in some deep way?
It's a regenerative thing. I think I put out a lot in work, and it's a much more social environment that I think I'm naturally inclined to be in, and then when I go home, it's getting strength again to go back out there.
Oh, I see. So you may be by inclination a person who likes being alone or solitude or quiet, but then you have work that makes you brings you a lot of social contact with people and drains you, and then you regenerate by going being alone. So in addition to the pleasure of just being solitary by itself, there's also something regenerating about it. It might be helpful for you to start looking at what happens to you at work that drains you, with the assumption. The kind of operating assumption you should probably work with is the reason that you need to be regenerated is because there's some way in which you are at work, which you are at work, which drains you. Mm-hmm. And for you to take to look and see what is it that I'm doing, that you're doing, and when you're around other people, are you tend to be afraid a lot and that tires you, or you tend to be, you know. You tend to give yourself over too much to other people, or what is it that you do? And explore that and see if there's some way that you can work on that and see if you can have a healthier way of being at work. And then you might find you need less regeneration. And then you might stay solitary just as much as you always do, but has a different function. Or you might not need to be alone so much when you get home. And then you might have more time for a little bit of a social life too. So it sounds to me like rather than focusing on healthier solitude, it's probably focusing on healthier relationships. Please.
To keeping our conversation at a very harmonious level, like I'll suppress those thoughts and then try and just keep it happy. And then later, in retrospect, I look at it and I say, that didn't feel very good, but I know why I did the things I did, and I don't know how to change it sometimes. So just any exercises. I mean, I think a lot of it's just now I'm becoming more aware of it and more receptive to speaking up for it. Even if it's after the fact, but I'm slowly getting closer to the time when it happens. But if you have any ideas of how to like expedite that process of being so aware that I can stop it then, so I don't have as much to remember later.
Yeah, great. It's a great question. I don't know if this is relevant to what you're bringing out, but it occurs to me is. It's not if you feel conflict with someone, disagreement with someone, it's not always necessary to speak it. Sometimes it's okay to, for the sake of harmony or for the sake of whatever, not to speak it. But you don't have to repress it either. Always. It means you can actually try to, you might actually, if you start feeling these thoughts inside of you, you might speak them louder in your own mind. Kind of repeat them in your own mind much more conscious, like you're having a conversation with them, but you're doing it in your own mind, so it really becomes conscious in your mind what you're doing. Mm-hmm. If you have a tendency of repressing or pushing away or not paying attention to those, try speaking them in a sense out loud in your mind. You don't have to say it out loud unless it feels appropriate or necessary, but to repeat them in your mind and see as you repeat them kind of second or third time consciously in your mind. Then begin exploring what's the nature of these kinds of thoughts. Are they always critical or judgmental? Are they simply disagreement about something, or are you know what's the basis, the emotional basis for having these kinds of thoughts? There's a lot you might be able to discover, and you might also discover kind of greater familiarity with that kind of thinking if you kind of begin stopping and speaking it silently to yourself. So yes, for an exercise, so that's one thing.
Sometimes I feel like I understand why somebody says is a negative thing or something that rubs me the wrong way. But because I've had this tendency for so long to just keep things on a happy level, it's almost hard for me to say something or to stop a particular path that the other person's on, because it brings in like resentment and like tons of being repressed. Do you know?
Oh.
You know,
I mean,
I think it's just a matter of starting, and then as soon as I start, it's okay. But right now, I'm just kind of like being aware of it.
Well, you know, one of the things to do with mindfulness of speaking, for example, or this kind of thing, is to choose some situations where there's very little risk for you, and then start practicing conflict or whatever. I mean, you know, if you go to a grocery store and you're never going to see that person again, and the person's being kind of difficult. When I was 18, 19 years old, I used to hitchhike around Europe, and I guess I was 17, 18, and I had this idea that I didn't know who I was exactly, but okay, I'm going to find out who I am by trying on different personalities, and I just kind of be a different person. If someone picks me up, I'll never see them again. I'll just be a different person for that person. You know, I'll just try this out and see what that's like. Try this, you know, for size. And I would be a certain way, be grumpy or be whatever, or exuberant or whatever. And I would just kind of experiment with different ways of being. And you might go someplace where no one knows you, where very little consequence, and see if you can just kind of, you know, forget about. There's some cultures, for example, really like conflict a lot. They're really much more into it than some Asian cultures, you know. And maybe go visit that kind of cultures, you know. and just, you know, experiment there. so go, you know, try out those muscles someplace where it's safe. Or if you have a really good friend, you know, go confess to your friend your issue and say, you know, how about if we just, you know, have a good argument about something. Let's try to decide on a restaurant we're going to eat together, but before we decide, let's have a good argument about it or something. You know, let's see if we can really kind of get into it, or I don't know. But there's a sense of playful experimentation and safe experimentation in situations where there's not much at stake, to kind of exercise a certain muscle that's underused. And also, with listening to you, it also sounds like, since you talked about there's being this tremendous backlog of feeling or resentment, it might be necessary to go and address that directly and maybe do some therapy, for example. Yes?
Yeah, thank you for the talk. It brought up all that stuff. One was, I'm just thinking about what works for me when I'm talking or need to be listened to. Because I really realize what you said, that most of the time when I'm giving advice, it's about some other motive for me, almost always. But I thought it's something to do with quality of respectfulness, whoever's listening to me. And two different people can say something, and one, the exact same words, and it's done differently, and I'll feel really listened to, and somebody else I won't. So I'm not sure on that, but the other things, I did have a question with this, but you mentioned about truth, and that's just a mind-boggling kind of word for me to really figure out at what level I'm being truthful most of the time. So I guess usually I can go away, I guess, and think, what part of me is being truthful, and da 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 da. So if you can say anything about that. But also, the main thing I wanted to ask you about was the speaking part. If one goes long periods of time almost without a voice, without speaking, is there a time that maybe it's important to do the opposite of what you had said, to speak up for oneself? Even if you're not sure or ready yet, or if you're doing it right, or that kind of stuff.
Perhaps it's an issue of balance. So some people are imbalanced in one direction, some people in another direction. And sometimes you need to kind of go on the other extreme for a while to kind of create some balance. And if a person has been repressed or silenced for a very long time, then perhaps it's useful to go someplace to really just speak nonstop for a while. Go find someone you can speak to, or, you know, become a meditation teacher so that you can just talk all the time and people will listen. And so there could be a time for that. And I did, when I was younger, there was a time where I experimented with talking a lot. But I kind of prefer not to talk too much, actually. And so I, there were times where I experimented with just talking to anybody who was willing to talk to me, and just talking. And I worked as a in a fast food restaurant for a while. It was very fast, and there was all these waiters and waitresses that would come out. I was a cook, you know, so I'd be at this table, fast serving all these foods up, and the waiters and waitresses would come in and out, and the busboys, and, you know, just all this commotion. And I tried having for a while there, I tried, once I kind of learned how to do the job, I tried as an experiment for a while, not exactly talking nonstop, but seeing if I can have a conversation, ongoing conversation with everyone who came into my vicinity. And so, and I keep trying, like chess player playing, you know, many different games at once. It was like I try to keep track of all the conversations. So they'd come in, we'd have a little exchange, and they'd go ballet and come back a few minutes later. We'd continue the conversation. Meantime, I was carrying it on with other people. And I was just trying to exercise my speaking, you know, and see what it was like. And, you know, it was, maybe, it was, I don't know if it was the best way of experimenting. But am I answering your question? Sorry? Yeah, practice. You know, if you need to, sometimes you need the opposite in order to create the balance.
Your remarks about listening. When you think of a friend who is not here, so I guess glad to tell her about this. But she is one of these people that finishes your sentence for you. You know, before it's even out of your mouth, you speak out where you're going, and irritated.
Yeah.
And somewhat distracted. And I find myself sort of, I'll start the sentence and then realize that she's trying to track it and take it off in another direction so she can't, which I guess is not very nice. But it's, let's see, your remarks about listening, about that delight.
The way you said it, I don't know if you need to tell her, because you didn't tell us who it was. Oh, then you might have to, now that she knows. So someone person knows. Yes?
One thing that I found useful, I guess last year you gave a one-day sitting on mindfulness of speech, and I remember you saying that it was interesting to take note while one was speaking, and I think while one's listening as well, to see what the posture is, whether it's expectant and eager, whether it's drawing away, whether it's balanced, and just to notice the quality of attention. And that looking at the body, at the way the body's held and is moving, has seemed very useful to me. It's not always evident enough to bring it up, but when I'm able to bring it up, I find it very useful.
Beautiful. Thank you. So let's end with a short sitting.